Welcome to the SMART OB-Med curriculum. Social media for advancing residency training in obstetric medicine. We here present to you a national collaboration between the Universities of Ottawa and Alberta. This research project has been generously funded by the Department of Medicine at the Montfort Hospital, empowering future physicians in the care of medically complex pregnancies. We hope you will enjoy it.
So welcome to our Advanced Learner Series. So we're going to talk about a case today, and I'm joined by two panel experts today. I'm Abigail Roberts. I'm one of the fifth year medicine fellows at the Ottawa Hospital in general internal medicine. I'm joined by Dr. Alan Karavich, who's been working at the Ottawa Hospital for 30 years with special interests in obstetric medicine, thrombosis, and general medicine. And not to age him, but he's been working in the special pregnancy unit since around 1996. I'm also joined by Dr. Patricia Lecca, who has been working at the Ottawa Hospital and Malfa as a general internist and obstetrics medicine specialist for the past 6 years, and has had obstetrics medicine training all across Canada and landing up in Ottawa. So welcome.
Thanks, Abby.
Thanks.
So jumping right into our case, I have a 34-year-old female. She is G4, T1, A2, L1. She was admitted at 25 plus 4 weeks due to an ultrasound showing IUGR with the fetus 0.1 centile. And I actually struggled a lot with how I was supposed to say 0.1 centile. She also had abnormal Dopplers. This patient is previously healthy, was taking prenatal vitamin prior to coming in. From an obstetrics history, has had a history of 2 therapeutic abortions and 1 term uncomplicated delivery 9 years ago. On presentation, had a mild headache. Blood pressure was 165 over 99, hyperreflexic, no clonus on exam though, and otherwise normal. Lab work showed a protein to creatinine ratio in the urine of 50, normal liver enzymes, platelets of 218, creatinine of 67, hemoglobin of 120. Ultimately, the diagnosis of preeclampsia was made. She was started on Adalat XL 30 milligrams twice a day and Lobetalol 200 milligrams 8 hours. So maybe we'll start with Dr. Lecca. How do you decide what blood pressure targets to aim for in preeclampsia?
I think that's a really good question, because it's a question that we struggle, all of us, because truth be told, there's no good papers to tell us what are the targets. So my approach is safety. So the most important thing is the diastolic blood pressure. We know that the diastolic blood pressure is the one that has perfusion, placental perfusion. And so we know that the usual target that we try to aim for in patients, let's say with chronic hypertension, is more a diastolic of 85. And in the CHIPS trial, we know that when the CHIPS trial is essentially a paper that looked at tighter control versus less tight control of blood pressure, in patients with less tight control, there was no overt adverse events. And so again, safety to let that a bit of wiggle room to be increasing that diastolic blood pressure. To answer your question, I kind of aim for a diastolic of 100, being cognizant that the systolic is also important. So kind of the systolic, my approach to that is, if it's above 160, you're increased risk of intracranial bleeding and increased risk of maternal complications. And so I try to aim at least a blood pressure less than 160 systolic. But I wonder what Dr. Karavich has, because we were saying that we probably disagree.
That's ridiculous.
Okay.
I'll just say, when I do these consults with the residents, the core residents, they are familiar with CHIPS and they're familiar with CHAPS. And CHAPS was another study, like CHIPS, looking at women with chronic hypertension or early gestational hypertension, showing that 140 over 90 or a diastolic of 85 was okay. And in CHAPS, 140 over 90 was beneficial. I remind them, because they often quote that when they're seeing the preeclamptic and that's their goals, I remind them those were not preeclamptic patients. So don't quote CHIPS and CHAPS when you're treating the blood pressure of a preeclamptic patient. That's a different entity altogether. So I actually agree with Dr. Lecca. I think you need to be safe. Safe in 2 range. You don't want it too high. So 160, my cutoff for worrying about too high is 160 over 110 for the risk of intracranial events and even things like pulmonary edema and liver problems. So I do want it less than that. And I tell that to the residents, just keep it safe. As far as the lower end, this theory that if you overtreat, you affect placental perfusion, particularly women with very severe placental insufficiency, it makes sense. I don't think there's any clinical data to support that. In fact, there's a recent trial that looked at that said that it probably didn't matter. But there's no added value of treating the blood pressure down to that. So I actually agree with Dr. Lekka. Keep it less than 160, keep it less than 110. You don't have to aim for CHIPS and CHAPS targets. And probably you shouldn't over-treat, particularly if there's placental insufficiency, growth restriction. But the evidence to avoid that is pretty lacking, but there's no reason not to do that, to avoid that.
I think, yeah, I think the debate also is, what do we do with these patients that are in clinic and have chronic hypertension and the ultrasound is showing IUGR versus a patient coming in with preeclampsia, and really the reality most likely will deliver in maximum a week. I find that discussion is almost moot of what our target is, because the reality is they're going to deliver. It doesn't.
For the preeclamptic.
Yeah. So I think, you know, in this situation, it's nice to have that mental gymnastics. But really, at the end of the day, it's just safety, and they're going to deliver and it's going to be fine. I think it becomes more nuanced when we're seeing those IUGR in clinic slowly, kind of that weight decreasing slowly, and that high, like, blood pressure slowly increasing after 20 weeks, and then we're a little bit stuck.
Yeah.
And then, you know, oftentimes I take a look at the medications as well, because oftentimes chronic hypertensives, often there's also diabetes. So certainly if they're on metformin, then I try to stop it. And then the debate is, well, is Adalat better than labetalol in IUGR? So I actually try to focus more on Adalat rather than labetalol. But again, this is a bit of a different situation than the one that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And that's really to try to prevent that baby from decreasing weight over the next couple of weeks or months.
It's actually a good point, because in the CHIPS trial, the randomization was a diastolic goal of 85 versus mm-hmm. a diastolic of 100. And there were actually no neonatal differences in the two groups. The only difference was in the mums with the looser target, they had needed more escalation of blood pressure therapy. So you could argue in those women, if you let the diastolic go up between 85 and 100, up to 100, you're probably not going to affect the baby in any adverse way. So I think it is nuanced, and that's actually harder than the severe preeclamptic before you on the wards, because clearly that woman is going to deliver in the next few days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm surprised we agree.
There's a first for everything.
I know.
We didn't need the boxing gloves. So bringing it back to this case, this patient was seen by neonatology, just given the fact that this fetus was preterm and quite restricted. And ultimately, due to the high morbidity risk with the fetus, they did choose to terminate the pregnancy, and the plan was to give mifepristone. Blood work did eventually show that the platelets were rapidly dropping from 103 down to 49, and the LFT started to rise. So the AST rose to 170 and the ALT 160. Hematology did get involved, and there was a unit of platelets that was given the fact that the platelets were below 50, and the plan was to give mifepristone, and a vaginal delivery occurred with the infant passing shortly after. 36 hours after delivery, the platelets dropped to a nadir of 25, with the liver enzymes rising into the 300s of the AST and LT. Bilirubin 18, INR remained 1.0, and creatinine 58. She was asymptomatic, maintaining normally, still hyperreflexic, but normotensive with treatment. So given this change, maybe Dr. Karavich, how would you approach severe thrombocytopenia in this case? And when would you be concerned about TTP?
Yeah. Before I comment on that, so she got a unit of platelets when her platelets were 40,000. I really think hard and long before I transfuse platelets in these women. Whether this is help or other MAHAs will talk about, the evidence that transfusing platelets help, I mean, these are consumptive processes, and probably giving people platelets is just making us feel better. Mm. And the rise in platelet is so transient that you're probably not really doing much. So I almost never transfuse platelets unless they're actually bleeding, and they don't tend to bleed. So again, that's a pretty low platelet count. But again, I think about, we talked about it in a previous case, other causes of microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, like TTP, with such a low platelet count, you should be thinking about that. As I mentioned before, 4 days postpartum, I'd like to see the platelet count up to about 100 at an hour, 100 hours at 100 platelets at 100 hours postpartum. And then you should think about other things. I mean, atypical HUS, I do think about, but again, that platelet count of 25 is very low. So the only real two things in my differential with a platelet count that low would be TTP or HELLP syndrome. It's completely compatible with HELLP. We don't see it a lot. And her LFTs being so high wouldn't be something you would typically see with TTP and the proteinuria. So I think this is quite okay and classic for HELLP syndrome. But again, keeping an open mind. And if you're worried and she's not getting better, measuring an ADAMTS13 and looking for it to be less than 10% would be a reasonable thing to do if you have access to that test, because that would confirm TTP. And as I mentioned before, if they're really sick and they're not getting better, you can just pragmatically in the moment say, well, you know what, I'm really worried about this and I don't know what it is. I'm not convinced it's just help anymore. I might give some dexamethasone. There's studies that show that'll bring up a platelet count, and it doesn't matter whether that's help or other conditions, and it'll make you feel better. The platelet count will be better. And getting other people to help you decide whether they need IVIG or PLEX is very reasonable as well. But I think this is can be quite compatible with HELLP syndrome.
And does that play, when you were talking back with about the platelet transfusions, does that apply as well, considering this one was undergoing a vaginal delivery?
So it's a great question. The problem, of course, anesthesia and surgeons, they'll have very strict concrete cutoffs. You may, your hands might be tied and someone will say, well, we need platelet count a little bit higher, so you'll transfuse. I'm just saying that clinically, I think it probably doesn't make a difference. Okay.
I agree that the transfusion probably is not helping. The only way I would kind of phrase it is give the transfusion while the patient is undergoing like the C-section or the vaginal delivery.
That because it doesn't last very long.
Exactly. So if we know it's going to consume quite fast, and that would be the only approach to try to minimize bleeding. And I have done it in the past, giving transfusion with really the asterisks, we have to do it intra-OR. And that, I mean, it helped. Who knows? But yeah, going back to the differential, I think I kind of, whenever the platelets drop so significantly, I kind of start from scratch and go down the differential. Is it pregnancy related? Is it not pregnancy related? Is it associated with HELLP? A good guideline that I use is the American Society of Hematology. It's 3 pages and it gives you everything that you need to know about thrombocytopenia. And then I kind of go back to that table and is it gestational thrombocytopenia? Absolutely not. It will never drop that much. Again, in the pregnancy related, is it HELLP, preeclampsia? Probably. We've seen it drop so low. But again, I think when it drops so low, you start thinking about all of the other differential diagnoses. So I completely agree, Dr. Karavich. And then you ask for HELLP. That's about it.
Yeah. I mean, we see so much thrombocytopenia with HELLP syndrome, but we don't see 25 very often.
Yeah.
But we do. And her LFTs were super high and her PCI was super high. So it really does fit.
And to the points that you were saying earlier, they, of course, did send the ATOM TS13, which was only mildly reduced. And the DEX was given to make clearly us feel better.
There's nothing wrong with that, right?
And the platelets went from 24 to 36. So there you go. This woman was, otherwise uncomplicated postpartum and discharged with some on Adalat and then weaned off postpartum afterwards. So I think a question that I might ask yourself, Dr. Leka, so for this patient, given the fact that there was severe preeclampsia, in the future, what in the future do they need to be worrying about for cardiovascular risks, for future pregnancies? How would you talk to them about that?
Right. So absolutely very good question, because we're seeing this more and more. And I actually started incorporating in my GIM practice, asking people coming with MIs, with stroke, did you have preeclampsia in your 20s, 30s? Because definitely there's an association. So we know that preeclampsia, and specifically severe preeclampsia, is associated with increased cardiovascular risk. And that risk is actually, when you compare women that the same age that didn't have preeclampsia, those risks happened 10 years earlier. So we're talking about somebody that, let's say, quote unquote, have had a stroke at 50 and all of a sudden is having a stroke at 40. And yes, the proportion is very small, but that is a huge implication for this patient population. So the goal is to look at cardiovascular risk in these women. I often say pregnancy is a little bit like a stress test. It's a mirror to the future. And so this is your stress test. We showed that your body's having a hard time with pregnancy. And so that will tell us that later on you're at higher risk. So we're talking about MI, CVA specifically. And then one of the things that we look at in our clinic, in our postpartum clinic, we look at hypertension, we look at diabetes, elevated cholesterol. We talk about smoking as well, smoking cessation, exercise, kind of a true global cardiovascular clinic. Yeah.
The other thing I'll just say about that is I have this graph from a trial that Joel Ray did in Toronto, an epidemiological graph, and it showed women who didn't have preeclampsia or placental insufficiency and then survival free from cardiovascular disease. And it just starts, the curves start going like that. And the worse your preeclampsia is and the more placental insufficiency, and if you have a baby with IUGR and if you have a baby who dies, like this case, that graph comes down quite rapidly. So these women have a much higher risk of vascular disease. So this woman who was at 25 weeks and the baby passed, her future risk is even higher than some of the average preeclamptics who have it early and severe.
Is there...
And I would also screen for APLA and all these severe...
that was my next question. And actually
100%.
My last question,
100%.
I was, you know, what in, just to kind of put it in a sentence, for someone who had severe preeclampsia early on in pregnancy, is that the reason that you're suggesting that APLA screening should occur?
Yeah, all the obstetric APS criteria include severe early preeclampsia and placental insufficiency syndrome. So the new EULAR criteria even include things like bad abruption, unexplained, fetal growth restriction that's unexplained and severe. We think about severe early preeclampsia, but all that placental insufficiency might be a reason to screen for APLA. What you do with that information for subsequent pregnancies is debatable in another discussion.
Yeah, and you just need one event, like one event like this in pregnancy, and that's enough to screen for APLA.
What are some key takeaway points that you want listeners to have after listening to this discussion?
So have a broad differential diagnosis for severe thrombocytopenia. It very well may be helped, but it can be something else, other microangiopathic hemolytic anemias. Don't forget about their vascular risk factor and make sure someone like Dr. Lekka sees them and talks about those risks, particularly if the case was severe, associated with bad fetal growth or loss. Think about next pregnancies and what you want to do to prevent. So aspirin, and we can talk about the timing in another case and how important that is. Screen for other things like APLA. And the last thing, if you work in a center where you have this option, there are some very specific and severe placental pathologies that can lead to very poor obstetrical outcomes, not just necessarily help in preeclampsia, but things like recurrent fetal loss. And these are very specific pathologies that need to be intentionally looked for by placental pathologists. And they include a broad spectrum of conditions. The most important one is CHI. So chronic histiocytic intervillositis, and it's an immune condition. And women who, and the other ones are VUE, vellitis of unknown etiology, and massive perivillous fibrin deposition. Women with those placental conditions with a poor obstetrical outcomes, their chance of having a successful pregnancy with no intervention is very low. And I think if you work in a specialized center, you need to think about those things, and there may be interventions that can lead to more successful pregnancies in the future, and that's a very complicated separate talk.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.